On any Sunday in any American city, hospitality teams arrive to churches early to ready their buildings for congregants and visitors. Greeters are strategically placed. Welcome centers are manned. Trays of refreshments grace banquet tables. As worshipers filter from parking lots to patios, you hear words of welcome. Welcome to our church. You are welcome to a seat. You're welcome for the bulletin. Be sure to read inside. We've revamped all the music for people just your age. We hope you enjoyed your time. Every church highly values being welcoming. In fact, I've walked into more than one church with foyer signs reading, "Welcome home." That is a hefty promise. The promise of a place for any prodigal to be reached with a warm embrace, given royal robes, a signet ring, a block party in their honor, and to be fully reinstated into a place of social status that had been lost to them because of their past behavior. There are many ways to welcome someone. The hostess says, "Welcome to the restaurant. Would you like a menu?" Or the receptionist, "Welcome to my office. Would you like a glass of water?" There is, "Welcome to my home. May I take your bags?" Or, "Welcome to my country. May I carry your sleeping child?" Or the nurse says, "Come into the hospital. May I apply pressure to that wound?" Or, "Hurry into the shelter. I will hide you. I will share your fate when they find us." From an administrative position, church leaders understand that they need to provide a welcoming environment to all, where people feel comfortable coming once, twice, and perennially. Church leaders are careful to remove barriers to comfort for the average first attender. For sufferers of mental ill health and their advocates, welcome must come with more. It must come with help, burden bearing, triage, and a safe environment to be vulnerable and exhausted. Hospitality is a double-edged weapon of welcome and helping. Within the church, we must offer hospitality as in hospital. The way that I have been most challenged in my attitudes about hospitality have been in my interactions with the homeless population in my town. As is true throughout the Bay Area, Monterey has a significant unhoused and transient population. Because I stare down the prospect of homelessness like a dark daydream every time I consider how easily those people would be me were it not for a militant family and friend network that simply would not let my illness take me. I have given serious thought to the way I treat the unhoused as people, because people who don't have homes are people. First of all, I do not just offer them things that they have not asked for. Personally, when I'm standing outside a building, I do not want to hold a stranger's leftovers for them. The unhoused might not want to either. And because people who don't have homes are people, I also do not feel that I need to give them whatever they ask of me every time they ask me for something. Not even my daughter gets everything she asks of me. But because the homeless are people, because the transient are people, I always greet them. Because that is something I do for all people. And because I am a Christian, as a spiritual discipline, I consider, I do not solicit, I don't always give, but I consider any request that is directly made to me by someone I pass by on the street. I have had some mishaps along the way of learning to treat the homeless like people. After our dog Raglan passed away, we were all devastated. Raglan was a 40-pound miniature Australian shepherd. He was spastic and sensitive and so sweet. He was our therapy dog. When my husband Dave became overwhelmed with rage as his PTSD was triggered, Raglan would come pounce on him, anxiously licking his face until he calmed down. It became a joke between us that if you couldn't get Raglan's attention at the beach or on a hike, just shout a swear word and he'd bolt back to attend to Dave's emotions. Raglan was completely in tune to my anxiety. He could sense it. It seemed like only on my hypomanic nights, he would dutifully watch the clock, and at exactly 10:30, he'd bite my sleeve and pull me upstairs and into bed. Once I pulled the covers up to my chin, he'd hop on top of me and lay lengthwise down my lower body. He stood guard over my sleep, eased my fear of the dark, and provided a weighty, warm presence that cured my insomnia and retaught me how to sleep by the end of our 6 years together. A few days after he was gone, our daughter, who was 1.5 at the time, was asking, "Dog, dog, dog, dog?" My heart just wilted. So I went downstairs, pulled out his near full bag of dog food that honestly was about the same size that he had been, and began breaking it up into gallon bags. My husband came downstairs and asked what I was doing. Crying, I told him, "Raglan helped us so much. I want to help someone else too. I'm making bags of dog food to give to homeless people with dogs." Dave teared up and sat with me, and we silently prepared about 20 bags of dog food to give away. Those bags of dog food were in the back of my SUV for months. Somehow, I'd pass person after person after person with a dog on the streets while I was walking, but never while I was driving. So I started carrying 2 or 3 bags in my daughter's stroller during our daily walks. Anytime I was armed with dog food on a walk, no one to give them to would materialize. Finally, very early one morning, I was driving down the busy road that skirts Monterey's Fisherman's Wharf when I saw a shabby-looking man with worn-out clothes and the characteristic pit bull on a lead. I yanked my steering wheel to pull into the nearest driveway. He was past me now by half a block. My child was in her car seat. I had the car running. I couldn't chase him down. So I started yelling at him, "Hey, hey, excuse me. Hey, your dog. I have dog food for your dog." The guy looks at me, looks around himself, takes a few steps, looks at me again. "Yeah, you. Hey, your dog. Come back. I have dog food for your dog." The guy starts running in the opposite direction from me. When I got home, I unloaded all the bags of dog food into the dumpster. Dave asked what I was doing. I told him, "I scared a homeless guy today." He said, "Wait, what? A homeless guy scared you today?" "No, I scared him. I scared a homeless guy trying to offer him food for his dog. I can't carry these around anymore." I find that sometimes our way of helping is therapeutic not to the person receiving our help, but to ourselves. I don't think that is wrong. It is really the basis of short-term missions and volunteerism. It is important for the rich to reach into the less explored, less obviously poor parts of themselves by engaging with the underprivileged, marginalized, and sick. All of us give away dog food sometimes, not for the benefit of the person who apparently needs it, but for our own benefit, because we need to receive help by giving help. What I really learned with Raglan's dog food and the poor guy that I creeped out is that helping is relational. When you give, when you offer, when you help, when you welcome, it is an act of allowing someone into your life. This sort of drive-by giving that I wanted to do was actually repelling to the person I wanted to give to. He wasn't asking to interact with me. He wasn't interested in being involved in my healing process. I lost my dear animal friend. He wasn't offering me his pet vicariously. I realized then I should give what I'm asked for, only what I'm asked for, no more, no less. And if I want to refuse to give it, that is as much my right within a relationship with a stranger as it was the right of the transient man to refuse my gift of dog food. For the last several months, we've been parking every Sunday in the same open lot to walk downtown to attend Sunday morning church service. There is a middle-aged woman who is standing in the lot by the pay here meter every week without fail. She has 5 neatly packed bags. She wears a long coat and warms her hands in a muff. She has long dreads and always carries a library book. We call her our Sunday friend. My daughter and I always greet her. At first, it was with eye contact and a hello. Then she and I would ask each other, "How are you?" She began to sit in front of my car during service. And when I returned, I'd say goodbye and my family would leave. Sometimes she'd give me a quietly hostile look when I got back into my car, but over the course of months, she's never asked me for anything. A few weeks ago, my daughter was wearing ballet slippers to church. Our Sunday friend said to her, "How pretty your shoes are. Will you spin for me?" My daughter did a half spin shyly. Sunday friend put her own feet into position and began asking my daughter to mimic her. I asked, "Did you dance?" She answered with a slight nod and closed her eyes. I was really happy to deepen the interaction with our Sunday friend. The same way I like to share surface to mid-depth interactions with baristas at my favorite coffee shops, or the cashiers at my frequented grocery store, or to have a pleasant exchange with my pharmacist. It does not escape me that our Sunday friend has different needs than my other community acquaintances. So I decided that I wanted to get her a gift. I was ready to recognize that her situation is unique and that being kind to her must acknowledge her wants and needs that are not being adequately met. I wanted to give her a gift, not something she asked for, not something I think she needs because she's homeless, but rather something a little nice that I think she might like. I went to Macy's and thought I'd get her a scarf or a hat. I realize that women on the streets are especially susceptible to crime, that shelters are often not safe, and that if I wanted to give her something nice, it'd probably need to be something she could hide under her coat. I just love that she carries a hand muff rather than gloves. It makes sense to me that she is an artist just by the way she curates her clothing even in her present life circumstance. She wears a lot of burgundy and maroon, I have noticed. So I found a wine-colored, mink-like headband that could cover her ears and a matching infinity scarf. There were tags that said the designer, so I figured I'd cut them off so no one would steal them from her. But then I began to think, this is kind of an expensive gift. It's kind of a big gift. It is not an, "Oh, I saw this and thought of you" token. It's not a "Welcome to our hotel" glass of orange juice. It's an invitation to a much more involved relationship. I realized that I was extending to her an offer of ongoing relationship because I wasn't just giving her spare change or leftovers or unsolicited bags of dog food. I was giving her something that I picked out for her, purchased new for her, and it just wasn't nothing. It was something. It was something I would have done for my mom. I told Dave that I was going to take the infinity scarf back and just give her the headband because it's smaller. I told him I felt it might be inappropriate to give her both because it could reasonably give her the impression that I was extending an offer of more support than I was really willing to give. I was offering to let her ask me for help. All evangelical churches that I have visited offer tokens to visitors, branded ceramic mugs or to-go carafes or pens or water bottles. A gift is a part of welcome, and that welcome is received with varying degrees of expectation from the receiver of the gift. Is this gift something you want to give to me because whether I return or not, it is an advertisement for your church to someone who sees me drinking from it? Or is this gift something you want me to receive because your church is ready to adjust to the kind of support that a new friendship with me might entail? Welcome is relational. We as the church must recognize that as we weekly invite new people into our fellowships, we are weekly inviting an overhaul of our church family dynamic because new people rewire the networks of our relationships. The amount of flexibility that it requires to truly welcome a new congregant into a church is stressful enough on the existing social structures and power dynamics, let alone when that new congregant is a Beatitudes person, a person who might not fit or want to fit into the offered programming and established routine of the church's life. A Beatitudes person might require the church to reorganize, reform, or even transform to live up to the relational promises of the all are welcome principle that is the evangelical church standard. I had to prepare and take inventory of what I was offering to Sunday friend. How much friendship was I extending to her? What might be required of me to back up that offer? To what extent would my family be a part of this new level of interaction with Sunday friend? Did I really want to be her friend? Did I really want to begin to know more about her and invest in her and live her situation with her? The church has to prepare to welcome the Beatitudes people. Welcoming those with mental ill health into your fellowship, extending communion to them, a genuine partaking in the life of the church, takes intentional preparation, and discipling them without favoritism or condescension takes intentional preparation by the whole church family, not just as a leadership initiative, but there must be cellular level buy-in from every person who makes up the social familial network of that local church body. You must consider how much stress the existing relationships can take. An inventory of possible conflicts should be identified. Looking within the pool of current congregants and members should allow you to see what kinds of personalities, perspectives, and experiences your laity already has to offer. What kind of people with what kind of ailments can you powerfully offer relationship to? I call on the church to become the best at mental health care. Not for us to do better at mental health conversations. Not for us to reduce mental health stigma in our ranks. But rather for us as a church to be the best at providing mental health care to the community as a community. Because the church was designed for and is resourced to provide the kind of support and intervention that the American mental health crisis needs. When we determine that we are willing to take on this task, we then need to prepare for it. We need to prepare for what impact it will have on our existing relationships when we purposefully welcome Beatitudes people into the life of our church. For a spiritual formation exploring the relational nature of faith and the interdependence of our individual callings as Christians, please check out nataliehaneydevotionals.com. I have a devotional series called The Proverbs 31 Family. It goes deep into an explanation of how our effectiveness as Christians depends on the affectiveness of our relationships with each other as members of the body of Christ. Also coming soon to the Beatitudes people, I will be creating compassionate proactive response toolkits. That's right, CPR for your other heart. These toolkits are disorder-specific reference tools meant to be placed in the church so that advocacy and support is something that any church volunteer, any laity member can offer without special training or fancy qualifications. This episode of the Beatitudes People podcast was sponsored by the Rosenau Ayers family and is dedicated in loving memory to Kim Ayers Farr. Kim was an unbelievable mother, sister, friend, and wife. This announcement is from her sister Julie in her honor. At 49, something in Kim's mind told her it would be better if she was no longer living. She struggled with depression and self-love, yet gave love to others like no other. These are words of wisdom that Kim gave to her daughter, Sierra, before her death. The most useless thing to do is worry. The greatest joy is giving. The most satisfying work is helping others. The ugliest personality trait is selfishness. The most endangered species is dedicated leadership. The greatest shot in the arm is encouragement. The greatest problem to overcome is fear. The most effective sleeping pill is peace of mind. The most powerful force in life is love. The most dangerous pariah is a gossiper. the world's most incredible computer is the brain. The worst thing to be without is hope. The most worthless emotion is self-pity. The greatest asset is faith. Even while being able to communicate these powerful insights, Kim was not able to tell anyone that she was struggling to be on this earth. We need to open up a discussion and talk. Depression is just life. We need to bring it out of the dark. We need to talk about suicide among adults. Open a discussion with someone today. You may save a life. I wish I could have saved my sister. Thank you, Julie, for your generous financial support of the Beatitudes People podcast. Now, let me leave you with this narrative from the Gospel of Mark. So Jesus and his disciples went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. By this time, it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. "This is a remote place," they said, "and it's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "That would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much money on bread and give it to them to eat?" "How many loaves do you have?" he asked. "Go and see." When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of men who had eaten was 5,000. It is natural to count the costs of extending welcome to a new and more challenging demographic of people. What if we don't have enough? What if it will be too expensive? Can't we just have them help themselves? When Jesus saw the people, he had compassion on them. We must also. Until next time, God bless, and go and see how much you have to give.